which advertising techniques work best, which don't work. And of course, a lot of what doesn't work is discovered by the market process. And so in a nutshell, that's what the Austrian view of competition is. And this was really, this was Adam Smith's view. It was the view of economic writers all up until the early 20th century, actually. And it wasn't until the early 20th century, around the 1920s and 30s, that economists started thinking of competition in terms of the competitive model, or the perfect competition model, as it is sometimes called. And probably the 1930s was the watershed. And those of you who've had economics, microeconomics, I assume everybody probably has, who's taking this course, you know that, that is an equilibrium model. It's not a model that's very close at all to the what the ordinary person would think of as competition. The ordinary person thinks of competition as price cutting, advertising, product differentiation, constant experimentation to try to lure customers to your business. The equilibrium model of the competitive model is very different, and of course it's based on a number of assumptions, and the assumptions have varied over the years, but the main ones originally, certainly in the 1920s and 30s, for decades thereafter, were one, many firms, two, producing homogeneous products, three, charging homogeneous prices, everyone charges the same price, four, perfect information, on the consumer side and on the supply side as well, and also costless entry and exit. And that model, the model of perfect competition, which you're all probably familiar with from your education, it was really only intended to be a model of price competition. All other forms of competition are really not dealt with at all in that model. It's a model of price competition. That's why the assumption of homogeneous products is in there. And so the focus was always meant to be on what happens with price and only price, okay? And so Hayek's article is a very telling statement on page 94, where he says, when you consider these two ways of thinking about competition, he says, competition is by its nature a dynamic process whose essential characteristics are assumed away by the assumptions underlying the static analysis. Static analysis is the equilibrium model, and that is really true. All real competition is assumed away in the model of perfect competition. And as an example of this, how absurd this has become, I sometimes, when I give talks to this to groups of students, I drag out old editions of Paul Samuelson's famous textbook, Principles of Economics textbook. And in the sections on competition, this was the biggest selling book from 1948 until the early 80s, really, and all over the world. And most of the other books that competed with Samuelson's book were just clones of his book. But in that book, you know, he applies this perfect competition model so strictly that at one point he says that really the only competitive industries in America that he could think of were things like natural gas and cotton, because natural gas and cotton are very homogeneous things, and that's about it. Everything else is monopolistic to some degree, according to Paul Samuelson. And of course, the corollary to that is that therefore the government needs to step in and regulate just about everything. But it wasn't always like that. It wasn't always like that. A research paper that I published quite a long time ago, I didn't put it on the list, but it was in the journal called Economic Inquiry, and it was co-authored with Jack High and myself. And it was in, I believe, the July 1988 version or edition of Economic Inquiry, which is an academic economics journal. And the subject of this paper was what economists thought of the original American antitrust laws in 1890, around the period of 1890, when they were first enacted. What was their opinion? And we were able to do a survey of all the economists who said anything at all about antitrust and competition at that time. There weren't a lot of people in America who were professional economists, who had full-time jobs teaching and so forth. I just try to turn the volume up a little bit. Someone said the volume was a bit low. Try your own computer. But in general, what they saw at that time was that just about everybody. Let's see, what is Daniel saying here? Okay, I'll continue then. Well, anyway, what Jack High and I found is that in the late 19th century, all economists thought of a competition like the Austrians did as a dynamic rivalrous process and a discovery process. That's the process itself of competition is how businesses discovered the best way of doing things. It's how consumers discovered what's out there, what they want, what their tastes and preferences really are, and so forth. And as a result, they were universally opposed to the whole idea of antitrust laws. And I'll give you one example of what they were saying. For example, there, even though there was a merger wave in the late 1880s in America, where there was a lot of consolidation, firms were merging, the economics profession didn't look at this with any alarm. And of course, that was violating the assumption of the perfect competition model, and that many firms was becoming far fewer firms in industry after industry. And for example, Richard T. Ely, he was the co-founder of the American Economic Association. Here's what he said about the merger waves of the late 19th century. He said, large-scale production is a thing which by no means necessarily signifies monopolized production. And Ely himself was essentially a socialist. John Bates Clark was a co-founder of the American Economic Association, and he wrote that industrial combinations would destroy competition should not be too hastily accepted. So he wasn't too enthusiastic about that. Another economist named Herbert Davenport, who was sort of the founder of the economics department at the University of Chicago in the late 19th century, early 20th century rather, he said that only a few firms in an industry where there are economies of scale does not require the elimination of competition. Another Chicago school economist was James Laughlin, and he said that even when a combination is large, a rival combination may give the most spirited competition, combination meaning merged firms into a larger firm. There was a well-known economist of the era was E.R.A. Seligman. He said the world would revert to a more primitive state of well-being and would virtually renounce the inestimable benefits of the best utilization of capital if these mergers were to be stopped. The founder of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, Simon Patton, said this. He said that the combination of capital mergers does not cause any economic disadvantage to the community. Combinations are much more efficient than were the small producers whom they displaced. And maybe one or two more. Columbia University, one of the big names there was Franklin Giddings. He said, competition in some form is a permanent economic process. Therefore, when market competition seems to have been suppressed, we should inquire what has become of the forces by which it was generated. We should inquire further to what degree market competition actually is suppressed or converted to other forms. And so what these men saw was they were seeing mergers and so fewer firms, but at the same time they were seeing lower and lower costs, lower and lower prices for a decade at a time or longer, and they were seeing the constant creation of newer products, all kinds of new products in manufacturing in particular. And so they thought this was all uniformly a good thing at that time. So this was based both on economic reality, what they were observing in terms of economic development, and also their theory of competition. Their theory of competition was essentially the Austrian theory of competition as dynamic rivalrous process. You might have noticed in some of these quotes, they talk about how you can't eliminate competition by just eliminating the number of firms. Other types of competition will take place other than just merely, butting heads of two firms. Okay. I'd like to turn to another quote by Hayek on this topic of competition. where on page 96, he says, how many of the devices adopted in ordinary life to that end would still be open to a seller in a market in which so-called perfect competition prevails? I believe that the answer is exactly none. Advertising, undercutting, that is price undercutting, and improving or differentiating the goods or services produced were all excluded by definition. Perfect competition means indeed the absence of all competitive activities. And he was certainly right about that. And now, the perfect competition model that was came to eclipse the older thinking of competition, the Austrian type thinking of competition, by the 1920s and 30s, mostly because of the mathematical revolution in economics. It's hard to model the process of rivalry and discovery, but it's the perfect competition model with these assumptions is based on basically physics. It was developed into a general equilibrium model by various economists, and so the whole thinking of what competition is changed in the minds of economists. The economy didn't change much, but the way economists looked at the economy in terms of how competitive it was changed. And so the number of firms became the primary benchmark of competition. It was no longer rivalry and discovery and entrepreneurship, but the mere numbers of firms. And this led to a different paradigm in the subdiscipline of industrial organization, subdiscipline in economics. And the paradigm was called the structure, conduct, performance paradigm. Structure, conduct, performance. The idea was the market structure, that is, how many firms there were in an industry, and in particular, how concentrated an industry was, as measured by various concentration ratios. For example, a four-firm concentration ratio would account for the percentage of sales of the four largest firms in an industry. Or they would use an eight-firm concentration ratio, something like that. And so that became a benchmark of how competitive things are in an industry. So you had market structure, which supposedly led to conduct meaning monopolistic conduct or competitive conduct, and performance, that meant in terms of the effects on the consumer ultimately, and other aspects of the economy, are there deadweight losses, that sort of thing. And so there was a fundamental change in thinking in economics. The economy itself hadn't changed, but the way economists think about it had changed. And one of the big problems with these concentration ratios as a new measure of competitiveness is that they ignored international competition. They were based on domestic statistics, on domestic competition. They also ignored potential competition. And also they totally ignored how a company came to gain a lot of market share, or how a few companies within an industry gained a lot of market share. So if you had an industry with, say, a 70% four-firm concentration ratio, that meant that there are four largest firms that have 70% of the market. There was no question was asked as to how they got that 70%. Are they just better than everybody else? If so, what's wrong with that? That's not anti-competitive. The implicit assumption there was always that there must be some kind of collusion or conspiracy. And there are many, many models that were developed, oligopoly models that were created that spun endless tall tales about devious behavior that is possible. Of course, anything is possible, as the old saying goes. And so, but the linchpin was really the assumption that fewer firms makes it easier to collude somehow. And so so what came after that in the economics profession, all throughout the late 40s, 1940s, 1950s, and 60s, were hundreds of studies purporting to show a correlation between industrial concentration and profitability. And it was just assumed that a cause and effect was concentration makes it easier to collude and conspire, which causes the result of monopoly power, which leads to higher prices, and according to the neoclassical model, lower levels of output than you would get with competition. That's according to the neoclassical model, not the Austrian model. And so there were many, many articles that found these correlations. Okay. But there was a problem with that. And as I said, they never asked the question, well, what is the cause of all this gaining all this market share? And one of the early challenges to this thinking came from Harold Demsetz, an economist named Harold Demsetz at UCLA. That's spelled D-E-M-S-E-T-Z. And you can look him up on the web and see a lot of his articles and so forth. And in one of Demsetz's articles, he did a very clever thing. He looked at one of the studies that was done that had a sample of manufacturing industries from the U.S. and ran simple statistical correlations between levels of industrial concentration by industry and profitability, and found positive correlations. Demsetz disaggregated the data. And what he did was he looked at the individual firms in the industries, and he found that that the larger firms tended to have higher profit margins. That is, a bigger gap between price and average total cost for the bigger firms with more volume of sales in the industries than the smaller firms. Smaller firms had a smaller gap between price and average total cost. And the reason for that, of course, was economies of scale. The larger firms, for various reasons, were just better at selling than the other ones, and so they had economies of scale. So you had the price determined by supply and demand. You had this price umbrella in these industries, and not all firms were earning the same level of profit. And the reason why some of the bigger ones were earning bigger profits was efficiency. Economic efficiency or economies of scale, not any kind of conspiracy. And so once Demsetz did that was in the late 60s, I believe, there was a whole slew of articles published in the economics profession, many of which were in the Journal of Law and Economics, following up on this and showing the exact same thing, that the main cause of industrial concentration is simply superior performance in the eyes of the consumer by one or a few firms within each industry. And this came to be known as the new learning in industrial organization, although it was really the old learning. It was really a rediscovery of the types of things that I just read from those quotations that the 19th century and early 20th century economists knew from their experience. And in fact, the modern economists, to my knowledge, never even cited these people. They never even looked into the fact that these people already knew this. 50, 60 years earlier, and they didn't have to be rediscovered if they had studied their history, but they apparently didn't. And so that was one big blow to the perfect competition model and its auxiliary paradigm, the structure conduct performance model. Another person who was very instrumental in this revolution. And there was a book published called Industrial Concentration, The New Learning. It was an edited book of readings on this. The second person was Yale Brozen, B-R-O-Z-E-N. And he did some early studies in this area also. And one of the things he did was he had this large database of American manufacturing companies, and he listed them at the different peaks of the business cycle, like 1948, 1956, 1965, wherever the peaks of the business cycle were. He tried to control for the business cycles, and he looked at profitability and concentration at the same time. And in a nutshell, what Yale Brozen found is that if you look at these industries as a snapshot at any one point in time, you'll see that a few firms have a big share of the market. You might have the industries might be concentrated. There's always one or a few firms who are better than everybody else in the eyes of the consumer. But if you look over time, if you look over in a fairly short amount of time, just a decade or so, what he found over about a 30-year period was that at any one year, the firms that are at the top in terms of profitability and in this highly concentrated industry, their profits would be reduced, and they would descend toward the median. And at the same time, the ones that were at the bottom, most of the firms at the bottom of the rankings would ascend upward toward the median also. And he did this for about, I think, 8 to 10 year periods over an entire 30-year period. And so he found that American manufacturing was constantly in flux. At any one point in time, if you take a snapshot picture, it'll look monopolistic according to that definition of monopoly in terms of industrial concentration. But if you take the more Austrian view of competition as an ongoing process, you don't see monopoly at all there. And so and Rosen and Demsetz never called themselves Austrians, as far as I know, but the heart of what they did was to rediscover and to apply the Austrian way of thinking about competition as a dynamic, rivalrous process, as opposed to thinking of it as an equilibrium condition. And so that really began to change things around. So by the time you get to the late 1970s, the thinking in the economics profession on industrial organization was that more often than not, industrial concentration was caused by superior efficiency on the part of one or a few firms. And there were many theories that were spun about how mergers had bad effects or deleterious effects on the consumer. And one of them that was very popular in the 50s and 60s was the domino theory of mergers. This was a theory that attempted to explain merger waves. And so it said that, you know, once you see, say, an industry with 20 firms competing, two of them merge, and it leads to other mergers, a second and a third and a fourth. And before too long, there's only five companies left in this industry. And that supposedly leads to a monopoly. But when you think about it, what typically happens is when the first two companies merge, the only reason other companies would follow is that the merger must have accomplished economies of scale. If they merged and caused them to raise their price, the other companies would be happy with that. They could then raise their price too, or undersell the new merged company. But if the new merged company achieves economies of scale through the merger, and that enables them to have a price advantage over all the competition, all the competition has to get its act together and figure out a way to cut its costs and prices also, or they lose market share and go out of business eventually. And so the domino theory of merger waves really can only be explained as a competitive device where firms are competing to cut costs by achieving economies of scale. It doesn't always work out that way. Not all mergers lead to lower cost and economies of scale, because people are not omniscient, but that's the way it typically works. And so so that theory has been pretty much debunked as a theory of monopoly. And another aspect of this, in terms of the many firms assumption of the old monopoly model, is that in the mid-1960s also, economists started talking about the merger for corporate control. The market for corporate control. And the seminal article on this was by Henry Manne, spelled M-A-N-N-E, and that was in the Journal of Political Economy in 1965, and it was called Mergers and the Market for Corporate Control. And it recognized that, there is a problem of the separation of ownership from control in industry, in that the owners are stockholders and the controllers are the professional managers. And their interests might not coincide. They might have different interests. The managers might want to spend excessive amounts of money on perks, on corporate jets and country club memberships and lavish salaries and pensions and things like that. Whereas the stockholders, of course, they want them to make profits for them, dividends. And so what Manny did was to explain how the market itself has come up with various devices that discipline this type of behavior of spending too much money on personal perks and privileges and squandering money that really is the property of the stockholders on yourself as a manager. And the way it works is if this type of behavior is excessive, or if the managers are excessively lazy and or incompetent, then the stock price will decline. The firm will become undervalued. And there's a whole industry of people who make a living by spotting undervalued firms. And then what they do is they can put together a takeover bid through various mechanisms, such as a proxy fight, proxy battle, where they buy up shares of stock. They get investors together with large amounts of money to buy up shares of stock. If your stock is selling at $10 a share today, they might say, we will give you $15 a share right now for your stock. And once they earn a majority of the stock, then they're able to control the board of directors. And they can use their control of the board of directors to fire the incompetent management and replace them. That's why it's called the market for corporate control. It's competition in the market for who will be the controller, the management of the company. And since the people who have participated in the takeover are now the biggest stockholders, they certainly have every incentive to make the company more profitable by making it more efficient and providing better products and services. That doesn't guarantee that they will. Many takeovers don't work out, but that's the idea, and they certainly have the incentive in the right place to do that. And so that's a second explanation, in addition to the domino theory, or third explanation, in addition to economies of scale and the domino theory, and of what mergers are about in the economic world. They're mostly about efficiency, attempts to achieve efficiency. But like I said, they don't always work out because human beings are not omniscient. We make educated guesses to do these things, and so the many firms assumption has mostly been thrown out by economists who study these things, but it is still there in the textbooks. The antitrust litigators still use it, and the government regulators still use concentration ratios. I'll give one anecdote or one example of how this has been used or misused or abused is when I lived in the state of Tennessee in the U.S., the town I lived in, there was a grocery chain. It was a small grocery chain that had about a dozen stores, but it was very, very successful. It had 60% of the grocery market, even though it had competition from other grocery chains such as Food Lion, Kroger's, Winn-Dixie, which is very big in the southern states in the United States, and several others. But it had 60% of the market. On the sole basis that it had 60% of the market, the U.S. government, with its Federal Trade Commission, sued this grocery chain. It had a weird name. It was called the Red Food Store, as in the color red. They sued them for violating the antitrust laws for having too much of a market share. And so they just assumed that because they had a 60% market share, they were monopolistic. And it went to court. It lasted about a year and a half in litigation, and a federal judge found in favor of the grocery chain. And what the judge found was that the reason why this store had a 60% market share, the main reason, was that it had the smallest profit margin on almost all of its products. For example, if it paid 20 cents for a can of peas, it would charge 25 cents to the customer, whereas everyone else was charging 28 or 29 cents to the customer for the same can of peas. So they had a smaller profit margin on each item, which enabled them to make huge profits by selling a much larger volume of items than everybody else. That's the grocery business. That's how you make money in the grocery business. That's how Walmart has become so successful. So they ruled in their favor, but the Federal Trade Commission didn't give up. They threatened, apparently, to keep them in litigation forever. And so this company decided to give up and let the Federal Trade Commission take over for some of its stores, which it did eventually. And so that's, I just brought that up as just one example of how this shift in thinking about what competition is from a dynamic rivalrous process of entrepreneurship to a statistic, industrial concentration, has led to bizarre behavior. This is a great example of what Murray Rothbard talked about when he talked about the use of statistics for central planning. He talked about it mostly for macroeconomic issues, but the use of statistics such as concentration ratios has also enabled the government to go on these witch hunts for a monopoly, when at the same time the government is creating monopoly all the time with regulation and franchises and so forth, which I'll talk about also. Now the next assumption there is the homogeneous products assumption. And the homogeneous products assumption of the perfect competitive model, as I said, it was put in there originally because it was meant to be a model of price competition, not of product competition. And so it was an attempt to have sort of a theory that would be kind of like a theory in the physical sciences, where you can hold certain things constant by assumption and try to focus your attention on one variable, price. But of course, it has been interpreted almost literally from the very beginning of the use of this model to be literally a description of real-world competition, a desirable type of competition. And what this has led to, this assumption of that homogeneous products is a good idea, there's some real absurdities. In England, at one time, it was government policy to build government housing, make it all look alike. Homogeneous products because they thought that would be competitive. And the main reason was there were two British economists in the 1930s, Edward Chamberlain and Joan Robinson, who wrote theories of monopolistic competition based on this. And the theory of monopolistic competition said that even if there are many firms, assumption number one, they could be producing differentiated products, or even the advertising itself could, at least in the mind of consumers, create the image of differentiation. And so that would mean a unique product, at least in the mind of the consumer. And if it's a unique product, it's a monopoly. So you had many firms all producing monopolies, was what the theory said. And so, so of course, just about every firm in the world then was a monopoly, according to Chamberlain and Robinson. And the British government seemed to especially take this seriously and try to implement this in antitrust policies. But this created what is called the Nirvana fallacy. And this idea of the Nirvana fallacy was coined, the phrase was coined by Harold Demsetz, the same economist I mentioned earlier, UCLA economist. And what he means by that is that what some of this literature says is that if someone creates a new and different product differentiation, you are, for a certain time, a monopolist if you define monopoly as a single seller of some unique thing until the competition comes in, okay? And so the earlier generation of economists said, well, product differentiation and innovation creates monopoly. This must be regulated by the government. It's monopoly. Monopolies are bad things. They restrict output and they raise prices. And so there were all these calls for regulation of product differentiation and the policing of product differentiation. But what Demsetz called the Nirvana fallacy is this. What these economists were comparing was the existing world where one firm has an invention and invents a new product that people like and makes some money at it, to a utopian world or a world of Nirvana where there might have been 100 people who had the idea of the invention all at the same time. And of course, if you compare the real world to that, to Nirvana, the real world always is going to fail, will always seem inadequate or a failure. And so that's why it's called the Nirvana fallacy. But the real comparison ought to be what existed before the invention. What happened before the invention? Well, there was no product at all. And so an invention actually expands output. It doesn't restrict output, it expands output. It gives you something that you previously did not have and you had no idea that you would want because you didn't invent it. Somebody else invented it. And so, and of course, not all inventions are desirable, but I'm talking about inventions and innovations that are useful to consumers. And so the real comparison is what came before, which was nothing. So you're comparing the production of 100,000 widgets that people love to zero widgets. That's an improvement in human well-being and consumer well-being. But if you compare the 100,000 widgets to a situation of where there might have been a million in Nirvana or Utopia, well, yeah, it seems inadequate. It seems it's a market failure. But that's a false choice. That's really a straw man being set up there. That's why it's a fallacy, the Nirvana fallacy. And this theory of condemning product differentiation, was taken very seriously in the U.S. too. Among those of us who have studied these things in the economics profession, there's a famous antitrust case, the U.S. antitrust case that is known as the cereals case, cereal as in breakfast cereal. And it was litigated in the 1970s and early 1980s by the Federal Trade Commission, which is one of the regulatory agencies of the federal government that prosecutes antitrust under antitrust laws. There were three companies, Kellogg's, General Mills, and General Foods, that had 70% market share in dry cereal, the cereal that you put milk in the morning. And the Federal Trade Commission said the reason they got this 70% market share among these three firms was brand proliferation. They called it brand proliferation. They said they had invented a new theory of what they called shared monopoly. They said these three companies were sharing a monopoly because what they had done is they had begun experimenting with all kinds of different brands of cereal. And some of them worked out, some of them didn't, but many of them did work out, and the people liked many of them. And this was at the time in the 1960s and 70s when Americans were becoming much more health conscious. And so they started producing cereals with less sugar and more wheat and things like that, less calories, better for you. And so many of these caught on, and they were rewarded with their investments in R&D and their investments in marketing and their production of all these new products with big profits. And there was nothing keeping anybody else from doing the same and competing, but they got there first. The government sued, and of course these three companies spent many millions of dollars and diverted managerial talent for many years fighting the antitrust suit instead of producing better products for consumers. And the companies eventually won the lawsuit when the federal judge in the case, a memorable quip that he made was that, I don't even eat cereal in the morning. I eat bacon and eggs, he said. And he was just pointing out that there are a lot of substitutes for dry cereal. Even if they did raise the price to monopoly levels, people would quickly just eat something else for breakfast. And they had the option of that. And so, they won the case, but you never really win when you're sued by the government because you lose many millions of dollars in a case like this, and you divert unmeasurable man hours to fighting the antitrust case rather than getting down to business and producing better and cheaper products for your customers, which is what you're supposed to be doing. Okay, so the United States government has taken this this nonsense seriously also. How's the volume here? I'm just checking on the chat going on here. Okay. Another point about homogeneous products. In the past 20 to 30 years, what has happened in manufacturing is what in business school speak is called mass customization. 50 years ago, 75 years ago, 100 years ago, the way entrepreneurs made big money and became among the richest people in the world the Henry Fords and the John D. Rockefellers was mass production of cars and of steel and things like that, produce a fairly homogeneous product on a very large scale that enables you to produce it very cheaply so you can sell it to the masses, and you don't get really, really rich by selling things only to the wealthy. You get really, really rich by cutting the cost and cutting the price and selling it to everybody, to millions of people. And so that's how the great entrepreneurs of the late 19th, early 20th century in America became really wealthy by serving the masses, basically. But what has happened with the integration of computers and manufacturing is mass customization. It is now profitable to customize products and make money that way in ways that it wasn't possible 50, 75 years ago. Most of you probably know that if you wanted to buy a new car tonight, you could go online and pick any car dealer, pick out all the items that you want on that car, the air conditioning, the type of air conditioning, the type of radio and CD player and all that stuff. And the leather interior and so forth, and just check the boxes, and then you can finance the deal online, and within a week they'll have the car at the local car dealer for you, if not less than a week. And so 50 or 75 years ago, that wasn't profitable for the manufacturers, but it is now. And so what that means is there's been a tremendous proliferation in product differentiation. And it's all been driven by competition and globalization. And then, just the opposite of what the old theory said, that we should be alarmed by product differentiation, because consumers' tastes are very different. They're not homogeneous. And so in the battle for the consumer dollar, businesses have integrated computers and manufacturing to tailor make all kinds of products. I think I read somewhere where in between 1970 and 1990, there were something like, we went from a dozen or so different types of beers in the U.S. to hundreds now of microbrewery beers of all sorts and all kind of tastes. And this is Tuesday, Thursday, St. Patrick's Day, green beer. Yeah, plenty of green beer being sold out there. And so mass customization, I think, really, in my view, it puts the nail in the coffin of this idea that product differentiation can be some sort of monopolizing device. It's not. It's a competitive device. Okay. The next point I'd like to make is the assumption of homogeneous prices, and Hayek talks about this also in his chapter. Well, this is part of the model, the competitive model. Everyone is charging the same price. But there are a lot of reasons why firms will charge different prices, even in different markets where they have sales. For example, it's very common for a new company to lose money on purpose for a temporary period in order to get people to come and try its product. It'll charge below cost for a while, or pretty close to cost, and make zero profit rather than lose money, just to get people to come in. The new pizza joint in the neighborhood, how can it compete with the existing restaurants, the existing pizza places? Well, it has to get people to come in and try out the product, and what better way to do that than offer them an eye-popping deal of a large pizza, 32-ounce Coke, and a sub sandwich for $8 or something like that. And that's done all the time. And so there are all kinds of reasons why competitive pressures might be more intense in one market than another. We see prices being charged differently. And so that assumption, too, should go by the wayside. The final assumption I want to address here is the perfect information assumption. And, of course, for many years, that led to the idea that advertising should be suspect. In fact, for decades in the economics textbooks, advertising was seen as a barrier to entry because it was a cost. It was said to be a cost that new entrants might not be able to afford, and therefore they can't compete. It was an additional cost in addition to manufacturing product. Okay, and so it was thought that advertising was being used as a buried entry. Not only do you have to produce a product, but you have to have millions of dollars to spend on advertising the product also. And so that led, of course, to calls for the regulation of advertising, or even the banning of advertising in some cases. But the Austrian view is very different. And that's also similar to the University of Chicago School view of advertising, and that the Austrian view recognizes the important informational role that advertising plays, even the silly advertisements that don't even tell you that much about the product other than it exists. You know, the girls in bikinis selling something, most guys will look at the girls, but they will eventually find out what the heck the product is that's being sold. You'll know that it's out there anyway. Other types of advertising are very specific. The automobile ads, very specific. They'll tell you what the lease deal is this month, what the kind of interest rates you can get on a loan from them, you know, exactly what the car is, what it has, what's in it, and so forth. And so what advertising does in general is it reduces the transactions cost involved in shopping around for products. So it makes it easier to shop around. And think of this. Think of how it would be to shop for tires for your car, if there were a complete and total ban on advertising of tires. It was illegal to advertise for tires on in the newspapers, on the radio, on the internet, or anywhere. What you would have to do if you were to do comparison shopping is go from place to place shopping for car tires and checking on the price and the quality and so forth. And the merchants would catch on that most people would not spend all day or all week doing that. They might stop at two places and compare and shop. And that would give them leverage to raise the price of tires because they know that the transactions cost of shopping around are higher. But if you could simply go online or open up the newspaper, the tire ads are all in one section, usually the sports section of the local newspapers here in the U.S. You could compare, you know, a Michelin tire of a certain size and see what the price it is at one place versus the other place, and you go to the cheapest where you get the best deal. And so it is under that view, it is bans or prohibitions on advertising that actually are monopolistic and should cause higher prices. And there have been lots of studies of this. One of the earlier studies was an interesting example of how in the U.S. In the 1970s, optometrists, people who did eye exams and sold eyeglasses, were prohibited. There were state laws prohibiting them from advertising. And the optometrists themselves won of these laws. That's why they had these laws. And so there were about half of the states where it was illegal for optometrists to advertise for eyeglasses. In the other half of the states, it was legal. And there was an economist named Lee Benham, spelled B-E-N-H-A-M, who did published a widely cited article. It was in the Journal of Law and Economics, where he did a statistical study of the pricing of eyeglasses. And what he found was that in the states where you could advertise, prices were lower, all other things equal, than where there was a ban on advertising. Then there were many other studies like that. That did that have pretty much provided tremendous evidence that that advertising, yes, it's an expense, but it's a part of the competitive process, and it's the competitive process that pushes prices down and improves quality at the same time. So if you prohibit advertising, that's what causes monopoly power, not advertising itself, just the opposite of the assumption that comes from the perfect information notion in economics. And an example I often give too is that some years ago, the Holiday Inn's hotel chain joined in with environmental groups to advocate bans or prohibitions on certain roadside advertising, billboards on advertising. The environmentalists thought, well, it's ugly. You know, you're driving down an interstate highway and you see the past a beautiful farmland and forests, then there's a big ugly sign that says Hampton Inn, 1995. Holiday Inn didn't like that. Holiday Inn thought that was very ugly. And of course, the environmentalists, the motivation was they didn't want signs in the forests or on the farmland. They thought they were ugly. But the Holiday Inn's incentive was purely economic, because if you're riding down the highway and thinking of looking for a hotel room, and if you see one that says $19.95, clean bed, clean shower, well, you know what you get at the Holiday Inn. You can get a clean bed, clean shower, but it might be $89 instead of $19.95. And so if you can't see that sign and know that the hotel is there, you're likely to go where the place is with the brand name, Holiday Inn or whatever that is. And no hotel in America has more of a brand name than Holiday Inn. And so by advocating that type of ban on roadside advertising, Holiday Inn was trying to gain a little monopoly power there through regulation and to enable it to charge higher prices. And so, and then another point about the perfect information assumption is that it has led a lot of people astray because of this mindset. For example, there are two economists named Frederick Scherer, S-C-H-E-R-E-R. I think he's probably retired now. He was a big name in industrial organization 20, 30 years ago. And a co-author of his name, David Kammershin, wrote a book some years ago where they had a large database on corporate mergers in America, thousands of corporate mergers over history. And they looked and they found that about half of them didn't work out. About half of these mergers were spun off within 10 years. That is, the company that was purchased was sold because it didn't result in economies of scale and more efficiency and more profits. And so they conclude from that there should be more government regulation of mergers so that only the good mergers will be allowed. Well, that's an example of what Hayek would call the pretense of knowledge, the pretentiousness of the idea that some economists or Federal Trade Commission bureaucrats who have no money in the deal would somehow know through omniscience that this merger will work out or won't work out. It's very unlikely because it's the market process itself that tells us what works and what doesn't. These are instances where people are putting up their own money, they're taking the risk, they'll reap the rewards if it's profitable, and they will pay the price if it's unprofitable. And so they have the strongest incentive of anyone to do it right and to make sure the merger works, which, of course, it doesn't always work. And to think that government bureaucrats with their economic advisors who have not a penny invested in something like this would do a better job, it really is the heights of pretentiousness, and it's what Hayek called the pretense of knowledge. And so if you have this mindset that perfect information is a desirable thing of markets, I think that's the sort of line of reasoning you get into. You'll do this kind of research like Scherer and Kammershin and come to these conclusions. But the obvious conclusion to me of all of what they did was that what all these data show us is what works and what doesn't. And the only way to know that is to allow the market to reveal it. You know, central planners don't know these things at all. And so these are the main critiques that Hayek makes. I've gone into a lot more detail than he does in his essay, The Meaning of Competition, on these things. But these are the main critiques that Hayek and Austrians make of the competitive model and its assumptions. Okay, and keeping in mind that competition is a discovery process. And historically, monopoly always meant government monopoly. The British common law of monopoly always referred to government grants of monopoly. It never mentioned private monopoly. That was a fairly modern 20th century invention, the idea that we could have free market monopoly. But government is always the obvious source of monopoly. Government franchise monopolies. Cable TV for years was a monopoly. The Interstate Commerce Commission in the U.S. monopolized the railroad industry. The Civil Aeronautics Board monopolized the airline industry. For industry, protectionism creates monopoly. almost everything federal, state, and local governments do themselves is a monopoly. And so we're surrounded by monopoly, and it's all either government itself or government regulation that creates monopoly. And when it's not creating outright monopoly, there's also a whole history of government regulation that is advocated by big businesses, big corporations, because they know it will be very costly to enforce these regulations, to self-enforce the regulations, and that they, the big corporations, can afford the cost. They can hire all the lawyers and other people that are needed to enforce these laws and regulations, but they know that their smaller competitors cannot, and they know that potential competitors will be scared off if this new additional cost burden is imposed on them should they try to enter the business, enter the industry. And so there's a long history of that. A classic book on this is The Triumph of Conservatism by Gabriel Kolko, spelled K-O-L-K-O. And Butler Schaefer also wrote a book very similar called In Restraint of Trade. And it's based on American history. It's based on the history of the late 19th, early 20th century development of government regulation, the food and drug regulation, Federal Trade Commission regulation, and so forth. And they show how it was big business, big corporations that wanted this because they thought they could use the regulation as a weapon against their smaller competitors and thereby create monopoly power in that way. And so government creates monopoly power in many, many ways. And as we'll see in the rest of this course, it really becomes sort of farcical to think that the government, which creates so many forms of monopoly, also sets itself up as the policeman of monopoly, the fox guarding the hen house, in other words. And it's to me, it's almost surreal that this is what happens. Excuse me. I think I've been talking for almost an hour now, so I guess I usually don't go that long. But I guess that's all that I'm going to say about this for now. That's the opening lecture. And I'm going to look at the chat. I assume we didn't have any questions before the class, but if you have questions, go ahead and type them in, and I'll do my best to answer any questions that you might have. Let's see. What were the primary claims of perfect competition and perfect information proponents to support the idea that destroying monopolies benefits consumers? Is it really as simple as more is better? Well, the linchpin of the model is that under monopoly, compared to perfect competition, there's a restriction of output. And if there's a restriction of output, that means that some gains from trade are eliminated. And so consumer welfare is diminished, and so is the welfare of would-be competitors who would have sold more of that product, whatever that product is. And also there's said to be a transfer of wealth from producers or from consumers to the monopolist because the monopolist charges a higher price than there would be with competition. And so the model laid that out. The model laid out that compared to the competitive equilibrium under competition, the equilibrium under monopoly is an output restriction. And I'm planning on talking a little more about that point next week, when we get into Murray Rothbard's take on monopoly and competition in his chapter. And on the whole issue of output restriction is, you know, when you think about it, that's a very tricky concept. Because for one thing, it's a Nirvana fallacy. You're comparing a real-world industry to some sort of utopian ideal, and no one knows what the perfectly competitive ideal level of output in any industry is. Economists are just guessing that the existing output is not the best, is not the utopian result. And so that's one point. And also, in a world of scarcity, we always restrict what we do. Should we make the world heavyweight boxing champion fight once a week or once a night? He's restricting output, isn't he, by only fighting once or twice a year? I was at a conference once where a Federal Trade Commission bureaucrat was bragging that they were considering forcing automobile dealers in the city of Detroit to stay open in the winter until 9 p.m. because they were closing up shop at 5 p.m. And at 5 p.m. in the winter in downtown Detroit, in those days, it's dark, it's cold, nobody's shopping for a car, they go home. They suspected this was an output restriction, a collusive agreement to restrict output and raise the price of cars in there. And I asked this guy at the conference if that means that mandatory labor or servitude is necessary for economic efficiency, because what else would you call it if you force people to stay at work for 20 more hours a week against their will, and forced labor. And so when you think about the output restriction criterion, it really does kind of get absurd when you think about it, because of course we always restrict output compared to some sort of ideal where we work fingers to the bone 24 hours a day, but that's really the heart of it. And it was always said in the name of protecting the consumer too. The consumer protection was always the ostensible purpose of this modeling. You know, at the time the model was developed in the 20s and 30s, there was no consumer outcry about monopoly. It was the economists who changed their mind about what monopoly meant. It wasn't the consumers that all of a sudden thought they were being abused by monopolists. And another point I'll add about that is it really is an infringement on private property. I mean, if I'm a television salesman, and I own these televisions, and so do you. You own televisions, and we're both selling televisions in competition with one another. It's illegal for us to get together and to say, well, let's charge $50 more for these television sets. But this is our property. We can't force anybody to pay $50 more for these things. And so it really is, once you go down the road of allowing the government to regulate on the basis of monopoly or suspected monopoly, you are saying you don't really protect private property. You don't really sanctify private property the way we supposedly do in the United States. That you're saying that the government has a right to intervene and tell you how to use your property. And that's a sort of a non-economic or philosophical argument, but I think it's a relevant one. Let's see what else we have. Other examples of people who retreated from these ideas because of what they saw in the real world. Born-again economists, I guess. I know of some people. I know of there's a well-known Austrian economist named Stephen Littlechild. He's a British economist, and he's very good. And some of my favorite articles in this whole area written by Stephen Littlechild. And he started out as a mainstream neoclassical mathematical modeler type, and he reformed. And he discovered Austrian economics and decided he had been going down the wrong path. Also, Steve Hanke, that's spelled H-A-N-K-E, at Johns Hopkins University. He started out as sort of an engineering economist who wrote mathematical models of urban planning, and he discovered the Austrian school, and so he went from being like that, a mainstream mathematical economist, to Murray Rothbard putting him on the editorial board of the Review of Austrian Economics in the early 1980s, or maybe it was the mid 1980s, I guess, at that point. And so those are two examples of prominent economists that I know of, Steve Littlechild and Steve Hanke, who changed their thinking on this. And a lot of the Chicago schoolers adopted the Austrian way of thinking. They wouldn't admit it, but they did in a lot of their research that looks at competition as dynamic rather than static. Is there any arbitrary percent of market share for the government to consider a company to hold a monopoly? For many years, the government used 60% as a four-firm concentration ratio as some kind of arbitrary benchmark, totally arbitrary. So they would get statistics, Commerce Department data that they would use on sales volume you know, by company within an industry, and that 60% was the danger zone. And there's a famous story about General Motors that the top executives of General Motors all throughout the 1940s and 50s and into the 60s told all their managers to make sure that General Motors never had more than a 40% market share, because they thought they would surely be sued by the federal government under the antitrust laws if they had a 40% market share, even if they got that share, market share, by producing the best quality, lowest price cars. And so that's what I meant when I said earlier that this is an especially egregious example of how government uses statistics for boneheaded central planning purposes without really thinking about what they're doing. And that's one statistic that they use for many decades, that 60% statistic. Can I comment on the current NFL situation in terms of what is supposed to be the antitrust case against the NFL? I haven't read the antitrust case. I haven't read their complaint. But typically when these things happen, these are not serious lawsuits. These are just attempts at intimidation, attempts to hassle the NFL owners and their lawyers and make them spend a lot of money on lawyers. And the owners will sue back in an attempt to make players spend a lot of money on their lawyers. And I haven't really read what they're complaining about as far as the NFL. I imagine they're arguing that the owners, since they are the business side of it, the supply side of it, that they're conspiring somehow against the players to succeed in getting a bigger share of the $9 billion pot of money that they're fighting over. But I really haven't read. I can't comment on it if I haven't read their complaint, which I haven't. Maybe for next week I'll read up on it and see what they're saying. Feel free to ask any other questions. You don't have to, but next week we'll talk about Rothbard and Kirzner, the big names in Austrian economics and then competition theory. Rothbard, Hayek, Kirzner, and of course Mises, Ludwig von Mises. But Rothbard, Kirzner, and Hayek, I think if you understand, read and understand their writings, you'll have a great understanding of the Austrian view and how it applies to these antitrust issues that we'll be talking about a little later in the class. Let's see. Danny, Craig asks, how do the arguments for reducing redundancy come into play? Nationalizing the railroads, too many redundant lines, duplication of services. Duplication of services is just another word for competition. This argument was made in the late 19th, early 20th century to support the idea of government franchise monopolies in electric power, telephone, natural gas, and the utilities, for example. But it's, redundancy is just another word for competition. Rent seekers, as they're called, will use any kind of language they think they can get away with by calling competition redundant or excessive or wasteful. There was a lot of talk of theories of wasteful competition back in those days in praise of monopoly. And I think where that came from was during World War I, the government did give monopoly contracts to many major industries in America. And after the war was over, these big industries thought, well, that was kind of a nice deal. We had a monopoly and we could name our own price. But after the war, competition set in. And so they wanted to bring back this monopoly situation for themselves. And so they struggled mightily in all sorts of ways, trying to lobby the government and using all sorts of arguments to give them another type of government franchise monopoly. And some succeeded and some didn't. The utilities, so-called, succeeded in being given franchise monopolies. The phone company, AT&T, succeeded, although there was plenty of competition prior to that. It's a myth that these industries were evolving into a one big monopoly. They weren't. as we'll talk about in a couple of weeks. And so that's always been a bogus argument, that there's a excessive duplication. Let's see, according to the Hayek's meaning of competition and the idea of a dynamic process, wouldn't any breakfast food have been competition to the breakfast monopoly? Yes, it would have. That's what the judge in the case said. You know, there's bagels, cream of wheat, ham and eggs, bacon and eggs, fruit, anything you could think of that you would eat for breakfast food in addition to cereals. And so but what the Federal Trade Commission did is they hired Friedrich Scherer, who I think at the time was at Harvard, to invent a new theory called the theory of shared monopoly to justify their case, which he did. And they lost, the government lost, but thankfully the judge had common sense and recognized this point, that there are a lot of alternatives to dry cereal in the 1960s and 70s, as there are today. What policies would Austrians propose to address the health care issues facing the U.S. today? The administration suggests that a government option provides competition to the private cell health care. There is no Austrian position on health care policy or any other policy. Austrian economics is a body of theory and evidence, and it's a way of thinking. It's a way of conducting research, but it's not a set of policy proposals. But we do know that government competition is an oxymoron. Governments never compete. Governments have their capital provided for by the taxpayers. They exempt themselves from laws and rules that all the private sector companies have to obey at the same time. And so whenever the government enters into an industry, it has the ability to drive everybody out and become a monopoly. And so that's not competition. That's domination and monopolization that you'll have there. And that's what the Obama administration is after. They want a government-run monopoly. And they're being disingenuous by using the language of, we only want to add a little competition. But of course, we already have, how many? What, 13,000 health insurance companies in America already? And so they're saying, well, we need one more called the federal government. And so, but I'm not buying that. We have thousands of insurance companies competing already. We don't need one more. And of course, if that one more is the government, it could have the ability to drive all the rest out of the market and nationalize the whole thing. And that's what they're up to. And of course, healthcare in America is arguably the most heavily regulated and controlled industry, and has been for many, many years. And so the idea that there's a free market in healthcare is ridiculous. I'm not saying that you're saying that, but Medicare and Medicaid are socialized medicine for the elderly and the low income, and everything every hospital does and everything every nursing home does is very heavily regulated by federal, state, and local governments. And so and that's a big part of the problem. The late Milton Friedman published an article that's on the web. It's called Input and Output in Medical Care. It's published by the Hoover Institute, and in which he argued that over the past century, as governments took on a bigger and bigger role in healthcare, we went from a situation where healthcare was mostly proprietary, hospitals mostly proprietary, to mostly government-owned or government-run, government-controlled. And as a result, the more we spend, the less healthcare we get. He calls it an economic black hole in this article of his. And so deregulation is certainly one thing that is certainly necessary. For example, in the state of Maryland, which I've studied a little bit, there are 62 different mandates on health insurers. If you sell health insurance in the state of Maryland, you have to cover 62 different things. You have to cover, it might be hair weaving and all these things, or else you can't sell health insurance in the state of Maryland. So it's illegal to just offer basic health insurance. It would be very cheap, and the cover is maybe catastrophic and a few other things. You have to cover all 62, and that's because there are 62 trade associations out there that have been successful in getting the legislature to mandate that if you sell health insurance, you have to cover their thing, whatever they do, their particular trade in the healthcare sector. And so deregulation, one simple example of deregulation would be getting rid of that and allowing insurance companies to cover whatever they think customers would like. And because that all ratchets up the cost of health insurance tremendously. And that's just one example. There are many other ways that the regulation comes in and creates barriers to entry, barriers to competition in healthcare. Occupational licensing of all the different healthcare trades, you can make an argument that it has a quality component to it, that you know you want a licensed doctor and so forth. But at the same time, a lot of these trades require people to go to school for years unnecessarily to perform sort of menial functions within the healthcare sector. And the end result is there are far fewer people doing those jobs than there would be. And as a result, the price you have to pay these people is much higher, and the cost of healthcare is much higher also. And also, governments run most of the hospitals in the United States. So it's a government-run monopoly in a lot of areas of the United States. And government-run monopolies are always less efficient than when there's competition. So there are a lot of things that could be done, but that's not what the Obama administration is interested in. They're interested in control and monopoly control of your life. They're not interested in reducing the cost of healthcare. If they were, they wouldn't be proposing one big government-run monopoly of healthcare. Let's see, Danny says that Marx's contention that capitalism tends toward monopoly have influence on neoclassical monopoly theory. I noticed that Marx predicted that capitalism would eventually end up in one big monopoly, that there would be more and more consolidation, and then there would be eventually just one company, one big company. And that was as stupid as all his other forecasts. But I know of some neoclassical economists who were influenced by Marx and in his thinking. There was an old publication, I don't think it's probably not even around anymore, maybe it is, I haven't seen it in many years. It was called the Antitrust Bulletin. I did research in this area 25 years ago. I was publishing in this area, and I was interviewed by the editor of the Antitrust Bulletin, and he was a true believer in the idea that we were on the road to one big monopoly. And he asked me that question, what I thought about Marx's theory, and he was a believer in it. And so, yeah, there are some people who were believers in that. And if you look at the economists, a lot of the economists in the 1920s and 30s, they were totally sympathetic with communism. FDR's top domestic policy advisor was an economist named Rexford Tugwell from Columbia University. And he wrote a book in 1930 on the American economy, in which he praised Soviet central planning to the treetops and bragged in the book that we Americans will end up doing a better job of centrally planning our economy than what he called those slobs, S-L-A-V-S, in Russia were doing. I've quoted him on that particular phrase in one of my books. And in those days, yeah, there were a lot of economists who were at Ivy League schools like Columbia, who were responsible for promoting these theories, like the theory of perfect competition, who were also a big advocate of central planning. And they saw this as one of their tools to centrally plan the economy, this theory of perfect competition and the auxiliary structure conduct performance paradigm that really was the intellectual basis for antitrust regulation for decades in America. When the antitrust laws were first passed in 1890, it was a couple of decades before the government could figure out what the heck to do with them. There weren't a lot of lawsuits until you get into the late 19-teens, that post-World War I era is where many of the lawsuits really got started, and even post-World War II. But in the meantime, this body of theory was created that rationalized and justified what the government was doing in antitrust regulation. Let's see, Michael says, I think a great example of government monopolies or regulation leading to the increase of cost and decrease in quality is education. Yeah, that's for sure. The government school monopoly is certainly an education. I've been sort of amused or disgusted by fellow economists over the years who create these elaborate theories of what are called oligopoly, with all sorts of, you know, a dozen assumptions about the behavior of some business firm that could possibly conceivably do certain bad things. And at the same time, you know, they send their kids to the monopoly school district. The government monopoly garbage collector collects their garbage. They get their electricity from the monopoly electric power company in town. They watch television at night from the cable monopoly that was given a franchise monopoly by the same local government that gave the electric power producer a government franchise monopoly, and so forth. So their whole lives are surrounded by government monopolies. And then they go to work at their academic offices and they try to think, now let me think, now where does monopoly come from? Let me invent a theory of how it might come about in a free market under certain, you know, 20 or so restrictive assumptions of the theory. And that's what they do. And the theories all break down, by the way, as long as there is entry or competition, which there always is. And especially in the age of globalization, that means competition can come from anywhere. So yeah, education is a good, public education is a good example. If most economists in 1890 essentially agreed with the Austrian position, how did the Sherman Act get passed? It was politics. It's an interesting story. Well, they politicians ignore economists when they give them advice that they think is bad for their political career and will reduce their power. They listen to economists when economists give them advice that they think could help them increase their power. And the way in which the when the Sherman Act was passed, I put an article of mine, an old article of mine, on the origins of antitrust on the reading list for in a couple of weeks. We'll talk about this. But it was passed more or less as a fig leaf, in my view, for the McKinley Tariff. The McKinley Tariff was passed in the same year, 1890, and it was sponsored in the Senate by the same person, Senator John Sherman, who was chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. And it was at that point the biggest, if not one of the biggest, possibly the biggest tariff increase in history. And so the government was creating monopoly power with the McKinley Tariff in that year. But it was blaming the creation of monopoly power on the trusts. And so there was all this rabble-rousing by the journalists about the evil trusts, which at the time had been dropping prices of the things they were selling precipitously for 10 or 15 or 20 years or longer. In the case of John D. Rockefeller, he dropped the price of refined kerosene year after year from 1866 until his company was broken up in 1911, dropped the price. And so so they ignored the economists. There weren't many economists to begin with. There were only in America, there were only a couple of dozen who were professional economists at the time, who wrote books and articles on these subjects and taught at universities. It was a fairly new profession actually at the time, and so they just ignored them, and they paid more attention to the so-called muck-breaking journalists, who didn't like the fact that people like John D. Rockefeller were making a lot of money, even though the way he was making his money was reducing the price of his products and inventing dozens and dozens of new products at the same time that were byproducts of the refining of petroleum at the time. And that's the same thing with Vanderbilt and all the rest of the these entrepreneurs at that time. So they just ignored the economists. Let's see, from Andrew. In light of recent events in Wisconsin, could you discuss Hayek's view of the role of competition in setting wages, his reasoning against unions? Unions, the only way a union can increase wages above the competitive level is to use force and coercion to keep competing workers from competing for those jobs. And so they sometimes use violence. There's a big fat book published by the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania on union violence. You can probably find it on Amazon. I think Union Violence is the name of it, and there's a subtitle. And I think of the name of the author. Armand Thiebault, T-H-I-E-B-O-L-T, I think is the principal author, and it's Union Violence. And it documents for decades and decades how unions have used violence, murder, and all kinds of terrorism and bombings and knifings and stoning to harm and intimidate replacement workers, basically. And when they're not using that, they're using legislation that grants special privileges to unions at the expense of non-union workers. And so the only way unions can push wages up above competitive levels is either the type of coercion that the government provides for them, or literally, violence and coercion and intimidation of the competing workers. The conflict between workers and companies has never been much of a conflict. The real conflict is between the unions and the non-union workers, not the union and the company. That's where the real adversaries are. They call the non-union workers rats, scabs, all kinds of names. And there's a long history of violence in America against non-union workers. And that's the only way they can keep wages above that level. And Hayek knew this. And so that's why he's critical of them in some of his writings. I've written several articles on unions on Mises.org, where I cite this book on union violence. If you just look up some of my daily articles and you find the ones on unions, you'll probably find that. I think the one that cites the book is called The Myth of Voluntary Unions. It's on Mises.org. Let's see. Craig says, many people are unhappy with banks. That's true. Do you expect we'll be hearing more about bank monopolies in this country? And will they try to apply the equilibrium model to justify intervention? Yeah, they will. I think they already are. Banks do get various privileges from the government already. There have been restrictions on branch banking historically, for example, which created monopolistic power in the banking industry. There were studies in the economics literature decades ago about how the FDIC and the FSLIC that regulates savings and loans, or regulated savings and loans, had the effect of reducing the number of banks that could be in operation for the benefit of the existing banks. And so the whole banking sector has always been pretty heavily regulated. And so that there might be pockets of monopoly out there, it's true, from regulation, although mergers per se don't necessarily cause a monopoly, even according to the standard theory. They never do according to Austrian theory, but even according to standard theory, it doesn't necessarily mean monopoly, just a mere merger. But yeah, I expect to see more talk about that, because people do dislike banks, and for especially the ones that were given bailouts for their bad behavior, and they'll deserve to be regulated. The ones that accepted the money, they have no argument against being regulated now, because they accepted the government money. That's why some of the banks hesitated and said no. They didn't want to accept money, and the government reportedly forced them to take it. Let's see. Stephen said he was listening to a Rothbard lecture recently where he said that, ironically, unions by and large don't succeed in raising wages any more than the market wage average. They may get increases in economic downturns, but stagnate in times of prosperity, and it largely evens out. Well, there's a huge literature on the union wage premium, and it's true that a lot of unions aren't successful. I belonged to a union for 1 year when I taught at the State University of New York when I first got out of graduate school, and I paid, I think, $700 a year for nothing. We got a zero pay raise that year. And so, there are a lot of unions that have no effect at all. And of course, the union membership in the private sector peaked at about a third in the 1950s, and is only about 6 or 7% today. And for a lot of reasons, but one reason is that companies can hire replacement workers. And if you hire replacement workers, they have the strike is not really a threat. You go on strike, you lose your job. That's a big threat. So companies or unions have resorted to what they call corporate campaigning, which is sort of a negative publicity campaign against companies, as opposed to striking against companies. And they hope to get the companies with the negative publicity, and some of it is quite slanderous and libelous at times. They hope to get the company to agree to a union agreement of some sort without involving the employees. That's the purpose of the new sort of what they call corporate campaigning by labor unions. But it is true that a lot of unions haven't been successful. Many of them have been decertified because of that. The reason why they've gone from 33% or so of the private sector workforce to only 6 or 7% is because they have failed to raise wages, but they do impose pretty hefty dues and other obligations on the workers. And so when the workers decide, well, what am I paying $1,000 or $2,000 a year for nothing, they vote to decertify the union. And that's what happens. It's under the National Labor Relations Board. You have certification elections to bring a union in, and you can have decertification unions to kick a union out, even if it's to bring a different union in or to have no union at all. And so that's been the trend, and that's probably what Rothbard was referring to, this trend of declining private sector union membership. Let's see. Is the concept of too big to fail a fallacy? They thought the Soviet Union was thought to be too big to fail, but it did fail. So you can't get much bigger than the Soviet Union, can you? And it did fail. And so, too big to fail. Well, what that really means is that somebody like Citibank has a lot of money that they can use to bribe politicians to bail them out. But from an economic perspective, the argument they always use is that, well, it's a big institution, and if it fails or goes bankrupt, it'll have bad ramifications for the whole economy. But that, it seems to me, is a misunderstanding of what bankruptcy is about. You know, when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, there was a British company that bought up parts of it, most of it. And so that typically is what happens when a company goes bankrupt, really goes bankrupt, not just filing Chapter 11 and reorganizing and getting out of paying its debts, but if it gets put up for sale, that's usually what happens. Somebody new takes it over, gets rid of the bad, unprofitable parts of it, and expands the profitable parts of it, and does better with it. And that's a good thing. That's making more efficient use of that capital and of those resources. But they use this scare tactic as though if Citibank were to go bankrupt, all those functions would just disappear. Not true. Somebody would buy up the profitable parts of Citibank, or as they did with Lehman Brothers. And so I think that's just a propaganda tactic that we're too big to fail. And the politicians love to go along with it, because it means money in their campaign coffers by these big companies who they wink at and tell them, if you get in trouble, we will loot the taxpayers once again and keep you in business, as long as you keep financing our political careers. That's essentially what they're saying. Hayek's theory on paying employees 5/6 wages of the previous year plus increased profits. I'm not familiar with that one, so I can't comment on it. What are my thoughts on companies with dominant market positions using that to subsidize products, squeeze competitors out of the market? Squeeze competitors out of the market. Well, it doesn't work. Squeeze competitors out of the market, the competition will come in. I mean, if it was that easy, everyone would be doing it to subsidize, cross-subsidize certain products. That's competition. If they're dropping their prices, you don't need to subsidize a different company, I guess, to drop the price of one of your products. But I don't think it doesn't work. You would see monopolies everywhere if that was a way of monopolizing somebody. If anybody who made money and sold multiple products could subsidize incurring losses, they could do that. That's a version of the false theory of predatory pricing, really, that companies will lose money on purpose in order to drive everybody out. And then once everybody goes out of the market, they charge monopolistic prices. But the fallacy in that is that, once they charge the monopolistic prices, entry comes back in. And so the question is, why would you think you could squeeze everybody out of the market by intentionally losing money? If you intentionally lose money, you lose money. And then when you try to make it up for it by charging the sky, you'll attract competition from everywhere, and you won't be able to charge the sky. You'll never make it up. So all you'll do is lose money. And so that's really just a version of what's called predatory pricing. And I have an article of mine on the reading list in a couple of weeks about that. So, Starbucks and Microsoft don't do that. What are my thoughts on the antitrust case against Microsoft? Well, the antitrust case against Microsoft, the government, I will talk about that later when we talk about antitrust. The government investigated Microsoft for 10 years and found nothing. And it finally filed a lawsuit, and the end of it was nothing. They made up a few minor things. The government never even accused Microsoft of harming consumers, for example. And that is the bottom line on prosecuting under the antitrust laws, is in the name of harming consumers. So the government never even accused them of harming consumers. The only accusation they made was they said that Microsoft was spending too much money on research and development, so much money on R&D, that it was causing its competitors to reduce the amount they spent on R&D by just sort of surrendering to Microsoft. And as a result, in the future, the government said there might be harm to consumers from less innovation. That was the government's case. The government didn't make the case that they were using their position on the operating system and the money they were making there to somehow bundle and things. That wasn't the case. That wasn't the case. What I just said was the case. And they didn't prove any of it because they didn't break the company up. It was just a relatively minor fine that they imposed to save face. And besides that, it's come out that I've written about this in one of my books, that the whole Microsoft antitrust case was instigated by Microsoft's competitors. They're the ones who wanted Microsoft to charge higher prices. They didn't like it that Microsoft was charging lower prices for all these things, its products. And so, the case is over. The government tried for almost 15 years to do something against Microsoft, and it failed. Not because it didn't have enough resources. It didn't have a case. The judge in the case was so biased that he was fired by the three-judge panel that hired him in the first place. And that wasn't good. And of course, if this worked, no one ever charged Microsoft with raising prices, causing the price of software products to go up. software products, the prices have gone down over the past several decades during the time of Microsoft dominance. Yeah, that's a good point from Stephen Davis. You don't see companies getting a monopoly and then raising their prices. That's according to the standard theory, the neoclassical theory, that's the benchmark. What's happening to prices and what's happening to consumers? Don't confuse harm to a competitor who loses market share to harm to consumers. The benchmark of determining the performance of an industry is the consumer, not the competitors who fail to compete. There are always competitors who fail to compete and who will dream up theories of why their superior rival is doing something illegal. That's what antitrust mostly is. But that's the bottom line is what happens to consumers. Any more questions? I'll sit here for a while. See if we have something else here. Some small shipping company is filing antitrust against FedEx and UPS currently. Well, yeah, they always do. Antitrust is sort of used as a competitive or anti-competitive weapon by a lot of companies. I had an MBA student who worked for a real estate developer, and he told me that if one of their competitors started building a development with a golf course, they would automatically file an antitrust lawsuit claiming he was creating a golf monopoly because there weren't any other golf courses within, I don't know, 10 or 12 miles of that place. And he said they intentionally did it just to hassle the competitor and to force them to spend money on lawyers and things like that. And so this happens all the time. A lot of it is an attempt at an out-of-court settlement of some kind, or to just harass your competitors. But yeah, I'm not surprised. The fact that a lawsuit is being filed doesn't really tell you anything. USPS, U.S. Postal Service, or UPS? That was a joke. Okay. Yeah, you can't sue City Hall. Okay, well, if that's all the questions, I guess we'll call it a night. Thanks for signing up. I hope you learned something about the Hayekian view of competition versus the neoclassical view. We'll get into Rothbard and Kirzner next week, and then the last three classes will be all antitrust, different aspects of antitrust. And I'll try to jam as much knowledge into your head as I can during the course of the course. And thanks for coming.